You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 14th of May 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
The pros and cons to having another Arab politician. On one hand, important to have somebody that can speak Arabic, understand those nuances.
Kathleen Burke and Daniela Peled will discuss Lakhdar Brahimi's resignation as UN envoy to Syria and whether or not there's much to be gained by replacing him. We'll also wonder why British political parties are so keen to hire American campaign gurus, and we'll ask why this...
So, what you gotta do, you gotta vote.
Frankly inexplicable advertisement designed to encourage Danes to vote in imminent European elections caused such a fuss, and how it ever got made in the first place. And before the end of the programme, we'll hear from the opening day at this year's Cannes Film Festival, where the opening film, which actually stars Nicole Kidman as Princess Grace of Monaco, has surprised nobody at all by being completely terrible. All that and much more besides coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, right now. An action-packed 60 minutes as usual, ahead of which here is Barney Burnham with the world news.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. Turkey's Prime Minister has declared 3 days national mourning as rescuers continue the search for survivors after a devastating explosion and fire at a coal mine in the west of the country. At least 245 people are now known to have died, 80 more were injured, and at least 100 are still missing. The mine operators say nearly 450 people have been rescued. It's thought most of the victims suffered carbon monoxide poisoning. Oxygen's being pumped into the mine as rescuers try to reach some of those still unaccounted for. Ukraine's interim leaders have pushed a plan to allow the regions a greater say over their affairs, but the exclusion of separatists from roundtable talks in Kiev cast doubt over whether the move could defuse the crisis. The talks are part of a roadmap drawn up by the Organisation for Security and Cooperation in Europe. The organisation says the Russian President Vladimir Putin supports the initiative, but it's not clear if anyone will speak for pro-Russian groups at the meeting in Kiev. The President of the European Council, Herman Van Rompuy, is warning Russia it risks more sanctions if it intervenes further.
After the illegal annexation of Crimea and Sevastopol, the European Union has introduced sanctions against a number of individuals and entities. The European Union will continue to insist on and work for dialogue and negotiations, and this is the only way forward to come to a stable, democratic, inclusive and modern Ukraine.
Britain and the United States have warned of potential terrorist attacks in Kenya, with British citizens urged to immediately leave the port city of Mombasa. Britain's Foreign Office said that unless on essential travel, all its citizens should avoid Mombasa and the surrounding area following recent terrorist attacks and the continuing terrorist threat in the area. The warning said there was a high threat from terrorism, including kidnapping, but it excluded Mombasa's international airport and another airport at Diani on the coast. Another round of talks on Iran's nuclear program is underway in Vienna. The US, Russia, China and EU powers have warned there's no guarantee a long-term deal on Tehran's atomic work is possible. Iran wants sanctions lifted, denying claims it's trying to develop weapons. Both sides say they're hoping to reach agreement before the middle of July. Michael Mann, who speaks for the EU's foreign policy chief, warns that the talks will be very difficult.
We are moving to a new phase in the negotiations where we start pulling together what an outline of an agreement could look like. We've already got the joint plan of action that was agreed in November and has been implemented since the 20th of January. This is about going the further step of dealing with all the remaining issues that have to be dealt with in the comprehensive agreement.
The search has started for a new envoy to the crisis in Syria after Lakhdar Brahimi announced he's stepping down. After 2 years of unsuccessfully trying to find a solution to the country's civil war, he said he was sad to be leaving Syria in such a state. Jane Kinnamont from the think tank Chatham House says it's hard to see any successor making a difference.
I think it's going to be an incredibly difficult job for whoever succeeds him as well. But the role of the UN is absolutely crucial here, because you have such a divided international community. The UN has been the only organisation that's been able to make talks happen, but sure, the results have been pretty weak.
A one-year-old baby boy has survived a fall from the 11th floor of an apartment building in Minneapolis. Moussa Daib broke both arms and is breathing with the help of a ventilator after slipping through a railing on the balcony, but he is expected to live. Doctors say his youth and the fact that he landed on a soft patch of mulch should boost his survival chances. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Barney. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. We will be back right after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's 18:06 in London. That's 13:06 in New York. Joining me now with their take on the news for the first half of the show here in the studio is Kathleen Burke, Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London, and Daniela Pelled, Editor of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. Welcome both. We will start with Syria, which the veteran Algerian politician Lakhdar Brahimi is the latest to give up on, having resigned today as the UN and Arab League envoy. The search for a successor is now afoot, prompting the twin questions of who in their right mind would want the job and whether there's really any point in anyone doing it at all. A little earlier, Jane Kinnamont of the Middle East and North Africa programme at Chatham House here in London gave us this assessment of the situation.
There's pros and cons to having another Arab politician. On one hand, important to have somebody that can speak Arabic, understand those nuances and understand the region. At the same time, anyone who's had a career in Arab politics is going to be judged by both the Syrian regime and the opposition on the basis of their own records. Somebody who worked closely with Ben Ali may well not be trusted by the opposition. He may be in an interesting position to confront the Assad regime as somebody who came from a regime that was itself overthrown. But that said, if you're Assad and looking at Ben Ali, you probably think that he was naive, if not stupid, to go so easily.
It's Jane Kinnamont of the Chatham House think tank here in London. Brahimi has been in the job less than 2 years. Kathleen, I'll ask you first, did he actually manage to accomplish anything?
Survival. Other than that, I mean, that's a lifetime job, isn't it? I mean, I can see the sinecure going on and on and on, but the man is 80 years old. He was making... It's hard pushed to think of the progress. The only progress is that they keep trying to make some progress. And that's not a very celebrating thing to say.
Daniela, is there anything to be said for Brahimi's reign as envoy?
Well, I think the situation in Syria has got to such a point that the fact that the all that he could have done was create or facilitate a peace process that was going nowhere, but at least give a framework for an agreement that would be violated. You know, Geneva... I mean, that's the level we've got to. I mean, Geneva 1 and Geneva 2, you know, what came out of that? Well, nothing concrete, but something that everyone can disagree on and violate. I mean, that's how bad it is. When her history books are written, at least that will give a structure. I mean... Kofi Annan tried this, Lakhdar Brahimi tried this. You'd be hard pressed to find two more senior diplomats. What this conflict needs is not some figurehead diplomat, but actual action from the parties and the parties backing the parties. That's the issue.
Well, does the very fact that this job has been done by two extremely senior diplomats, extremely, extremely senior in the 80-year-old Brahimi's case, does that actually tell us something in itself, i.e. that nobody at the absolute pinnacle of their career really wants the job?
Well, I think this is the sort of thing where a veteran pair of hands, a safe pair of hands could be trusted, you know, to fail. Sure, I mean, who would really eat it? Who would take on this poison chalice? But people do, you know, somebody wants to be president of Syria, which to me is not a terribly appealing job.
It is extraordinary. Kofi Annan, Lakhdar Brahimi, there's some discussion that that sequence could next include Kevin Rudd or, heaven help us, Javier Solana, Kamel Mojane. Is there a likely successor in place? Who would, if we're betting money on this, who would we be betting on?
I'm waiting for Hillary Clinton in due course.
That actually strikes me as weirdly plausible all of a sudden. I had a sudden chill at that suggestion.
Oh, no, not chill. I mean, she's an incredibly clever woman. She gets along with a lot of people and knows the levers of power to pull. But not being thick as two short planks, I shouldn't have thought she would want the job.
But is the problem here that basically the UN cannot actually accomplish anything meaningful without a willingness by some of its members to send men in blue helmets to back them up?
I mean, that's the problem with diplomacy, or whatever you, however you want to characterize it, because diplomacy doesn't really work unless there's some sort of menace behind it. There's got to be some sort of sanction. We try, olden days, you would cut them dead, of course. That is to say, with no courtesy, not with a sword. There's economic sanctions or there's troops. But if the thought is, countries aren't going to give things, aren't going to concede anything because the interlocutor is a nice person. So nothing is actually going to happen until there's a threat that something appalling will happen if nothing happens. And there's no sign of that just now.
Well, I mean, we've seen some movement in other ways. France, which has been quite muscular over Syria the last year, wants to refer the war, the conflict in general, to the ICC, and it's managed to get, you know, as I understand, the US to agree to this. So it's referring the conflict, not one side or the other. I mean, that is unlikely to happen because of a Russian veto. But I think that's, you know, that shows the direction things are getting. Would a referral to the ICC be enough to stop the war? Well, it wouldn't. I mean, international justice, that's another a whole other discussion. But it's some kind of action.
But what good is action if nothing comes of it? I mean, there comes a point when you run out of committees, courts, tribunals, institutions to which one can go, and the fighting goes on. You were quite right earlier, I think, Daniela, when you said until there's someone actually, you know, until the backers of those who are doing it back down or concede, I don't see that it's going to stop. I feel very, very unsanguine about the Syrian crisis, I must say. It's hard for me to see why it should stop.
But I think it's hard. I mean, you're quite right. It seems unbelievable. You know, 150,000 people dead and 2.5 million refugees. And just when you think it can't get any worse, it gets worse and worse. But at the same time, in the middle of conflict, it's very hard to imagine how such a conflict could ever come to an end. But there's no war that hasn't lasted forever. I mean,
decades would we like to travel?
Well, even the 100 Years' War didn't last 100 years.
It was actually 116, I think, if memory serves.
But it was not all the time.
Potentially a bad example. But I think things do change on the ground. And what we've seen over the last 3 years is the premature prediction that one side and the other has won. And we see what happened in Homs, for instance, which the government now controls. Maybe we're going to see more locally negotiated ceasefires, which isn't a solution, it's not a long-term solution, but I imagine that the residents of those areas are pretty happy about it.
Has the moment at which an external power, by which I guess I mean the United States or Europe, the moment at which they were going to intervene, if they were going to, has that passed, never to return?
It was almost kind of here, maybe, but yeah, I think it's certainly passed. And I think it's too late, really, as well. Which side? Who exactly and how?
I mean, it's a problem, isn't it? Because the Shia Muslims are in such a minority in the whole area against, you know, as opposed to the Sunnis. What is it, 10 to 1, something of that sort in the entire area, beyond Syria and so forth. So Syria and Iran have to hang together, and Iraq, they hope. Therefore, I don't believe that Iran is going to stop supporting Syria.
But Iran has made some sort of conciliatory noises as well, talking about delay. They're talking about the elections and whether that would be useful, and talking about ceasefire. So I'm not sure. We may get to a point where Iran might have a more beneficial role to play.
Well, if things are sorted out a little bit more in the nuclear whatever. But that, of course, is an infinite regress of possibilities. So one doesn't know. You're hopeful, and I would like to be hopeful.
I am rarely and unusually hopeful.
Well, the trouble is there is a definite ceiling on what one can reasonably hope for in Syria, because Assad is still planning to throw this somewhat preposterous election in June, and I don't think there's much mileage in sitting up all night awaiting the results. But he thinks he's won the civil war, doesn't he?
In many ways, he has. Hmm.
There's a civil war within the civil war.
That's the, it's pretty good fight if you're fighting a civil war and your opponents are fighting a civil war amongst themselves. And it's not just the fact that in some places the different rebel factions are fighting each other, but almost everywhere they're at odds with each other. They're not coordinated. That's a major problem. Also in the areas which are under rebel control in terms of civil administration, that's a real problem as well. And if you look at it as a prototype for what would be the reality in a post-Assad Syria, that's not very encouraging. I mean, there are an awful lot of complaints about how they're behaving and how they're mishandling the situation.
I mean, to return, I guess, to the point of entry to this conversation, which is the replacement or not of the UN envoy, is there any sense that any of the parties to the Syrian conflict actually care what the UN thinks, or indeed regard the UN envoy as just another weapon of sorts to be manipulated in their own particular battle?
No, look, I think everyone has to play lip service to this kind of diplomacy. Does it make a crucial difference? No, it doesn't. But even in this kind of awful situation, as I said, you have to go through the motions, and you have to have a figurehead. I mean, somebody will be appointed, and it's easy and obvious to be rather mean about the appointment itself, but it's a necessary one.
Kathleen?
Oh, I find myself so underwhelmed by the United Nations and what it can actually do. It's a good idea, but without the support of the great powers, it's difficult for actually to accomplish something in this sort of conflict situation. I'm not talking about the social welfare, the culture, saving people's lives and so forth. That's something else. But it is not going to be able to do anything in this unless the United States, Russia, and so forth actually want it to do. And therefore, we're back to the United Nations. Long live it. But it can't work on its own.
And Tony Blair is, of course, still looking for work. We'll take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, and my guests Kathleen Burke and Daniela Peled. When we return, we will be welcoming to London two of President Barack Obama's former campaign aides, who will be on opposite sides in next year's general election here in the UK. Do stay with us.
This week on The Foreign Desk, we peer somewhat optimistically over the horizon to ask what an independent Palestinian state might look like.
There will be so much goodwill around the world once a deal is struck between the Israelis and the Palestinians that I really believe the state could accomplish remarkable things for its people and for the region. It's just getting there that is just so devilishly difficult.
Peace negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians may have reached a stalemate, but if they were to succeed, how would an independent Palestine survive?
There is a bright future, I believe, to have a sound economy. Now we changed the way we play the game here in Palestine. We're producing products that can compete.
We hear from commentators, entrepreneurs, and established business owners on their hopes for an independent Palestine.
People are talking about one state solution as a way out of this impasse that is much more promising for both people, the Israelis and the Palestinians.
That's The State of Palestine, this week's edition of The Foreign Desk with me, Steve Bloomfield, on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Kathleen Burke of University College here in London and Daniela Peled of the Institute of War and Peace Reporting. Now, it is on balance unlikely that Barack Obama's former campaign guru David Axelrod arrived in London yesterday atop a horse and equipped with a cutlass and bugle. But if ever anyone was in need of the cavalry arriving, it's his latest client, UK opposition leader Ed Miliband, whose latest poll results have prompted a certain circling of the wagons. So will next year's UK election sound like this?
It's time for a new economic patriotism, rooted in the belief that growing our economy begins with a strong, thriving middle class. Read my plan, compare it to Governor Romney's, and decide for yourself.
And just imagine that in the voice of Ed Miliband. Axelrod is the second high-profile Obama advisor to have been snapped up in advance of next year's election. Jim Messina, who managed Obama's campaign in 2012, signed up last August as a consultant for the incumbent Prime Minister, David Cameron. Kathleen, I'll ask you first. Are you getting the sense that the British are just not capable of running their own election campaigns? I mean, the Liberal Democrats have hired a South African. The Tories also have an Australian on board.
It's quite astonishing. I really do wonder why Britain can't grow its own.
I take that personally.
Well, what can I say? But I mean, the striking nature of the fact that they have to go abroad, and the point you made, or your intro made, that two of them have come out of the Obama campaign, does make one wonder about the political widespread nature of both the Democratic Party and the two parties over here.
I think it's there's still this lingering besotment with Barack Obama. I was told shortly after his election by an operative at a British political party who will remain nameless that all these people from all the parties had sort of gone along to watch Obama's campaign and come back all fired up and sort of said to their staff, we should run a campaign like Obama's, only to get the reply, you find us a candidate like Obama and we'll do exactly that.
I mean, it's quite clear that it's this technical aspects that they're going for. Axelrod says he doesn't have ideas. He's going to contribute in that sense. It's not policies. That Miliband has quite enough really good ideas on his own, and so they don't need that. But what they need is, as you quite rightly said, is what you do with them. How do you mobilize people to come and vote?
Yeah, I can just imagine the strategists in Labour waving sheaves of paper around going, social media, social media.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's the level. I mean,
we will be talking very shortly about a singularly disastrous attempt to engage the voters. But Daniela, speaking on behalf of every single British voter, how do you feel about this outsourcing of your politics to Americans?
Well, unfortunately, I have to say, I was a big fan of The West Wing when it was being broadcast, but I watched a couple of episodes recently and it's very, very dated. So I don't think this is going to be a rerun of the kind of excitement that brought to political battles. Well, I wonder really, because Axelrod famously took on Obama when he was little known in 2004. And really, the campaign was about the person. You know, Ed Miliband, I mean, it's too easy a target to attack, but he is no Obama. And just imagining him, you know, can you imagine him saying, yes, we can? It would be very, very unconvincing, really.
I mean, what they're in danger of is having the strategists become the story. I mean, what you're going to get, especially from journalists who are quite sick of watching Cameron and Clegg and Miliband and so forth, yeah. and the UKIP chappy, saying the same things over and over. They're going to start looking at what their advisors are saying or what their manipulators are saying. So there's in danger, because it's such a good story that Britain can't actually produce its own political strategists and so forth, that's going to take over at times of boredom from actually looking at the candidates and what they have to say.
But I just wonder if there's something gets lost in the translation, because speaking as an outsider to both the United States and the United Kingdom, the political cultures are incredibly different. Americans are actually hopeful and optimistic. I mean, you see that in the difference between the political dramas the countries make. You know, United States makes The West Wing, the United Kingdom makes Yes Minister in the thick of it.
No, it's true. I was reading it in an American paper, I can't recall, trying to explain the Conservative Party. I think it was described as a more left-wing Republican. It's not quite the same. And also the election is about such British issues. I mean, Ed Miliband is very, very keen on the NHS and putting that as a pillar of his strategy. Now, is David Axelrod going to say, yes, carry on with that, carry on with pushing the NHS?
Of course he is. He's being paid to tell Miliband how he can best do this. He's not being paid, his whatever sum it is, to come up with his own ideas.
It's an extremely large six-figure sum for as far as I can tell, not actually a great deal of work. Neither him or Messina are actually even going to move to the United Kingdom for the duration of the election.
So how much would you charge, Axelrod, for your 2 days here this week?
Well, if I was Axelrod, obviously it's as much as I could get away with, which I'm sure is exactly what Axelrod is charging. I don't blame him. The whole thing just strikes me as somewhat peculiar, but we shall see if it works. I guess what Axelrod has on his side is that there's really only one way Ed Miliband's poll ratings can go from where they presently are. We will close with an example of how political outreach perhaps shouldn't be done, which is this.
Husk at stemme til Europaparlamentsvalget. Nej tak, du. Jeg tror, jeg springer over.
Yeah! When there is a European Parliament election, there is one man you need to call.
Hallo? Boatman, vi har brug for dig. Boatman kommer.
As a young man, Boatman forgot to vote at a European Parliament election. That taught him a painful lesson. No influence on climate regulations, agricultural subsidies, chemicals in toys, and the amount of cinnamon allowed in his cinnamon buns. Horrified by this, he decided he would dedicate his life making everybody vote. So, if you're not gonna vote, don't try to run. Don't try to hide. Because he will hunt you down.
Adult human beings actually did that. That was a Danish advertisement aimed at encouraging people to vote in European elections on May 25th, lest something have been lost in nuance there without the visuals. The ad features a priapic vigilante called Voteman, who is shown extricating himself from an orgy in order to wreak gruesome retribution upon non-voters, up to and including summary decapitation. Following perhaps understandable protest, the Danish Parliament has removed the video from its YouTube channel. Politicians and political institutions chasing the youth vote, why do they still do it?
That's just cringe-makingly embarrassing, really, isn't it?
It's brilliant. For reasons I don't understand at all, Voteman, once he removes himself from his well-populated bed in his sort of underground lair out at sea, rides into town on the back of two dolphins.
Yes, dolphins.
That was the detail that stuck with me for some reason.
It's horribly patronising, and I'm very glad it backfired, really. I mean, increasing voter turnout in the European elections is a huge headache. I think it's predicted to be less than 40%, and perhaps the only way you could do it is if you stapled a fiver onto each voting card. I don't know, but this is definitely not the way to do it.
One question that strikes me, which is wholly irrelevant, I suppose, or even irreverent, is how well would that particular cartoon do in Britain? Sif, the cynicism we were talking about a bit earlier.
I don't think we're too bothered about cinnamon on our buns. I think that's the major issue.
I think UKIP probably have very strong views on the correct amount of cinnamon on British buns. But you do talk there about the problem of turnout, which was only 34% in the UK in 2009 in a European election. In Denmark, actually, it was 60%.
It should be a bit less now.
It was probably bumped because they were having a referendum about something to do with the royal family. Does it not, though, illustrate, I'm trying to wring a serious point out of this extremely silly advertisement, that the perennial problem of EU elections is that actually not all that many people really care about them.
Well, you don't know who your MEP is.
I've got no idea who my MEP is.
Who do you blame? Who do you ring up? It could be. If it isn't, you'll be pleased.
The only thing that has increased people's interest in it this time around is UKIP and the rise of the right wing in Europe. And sadly, I don't know if that will be enough to get people out and vote.
I don't know who my MEP is. Is these the sort of thing I should know? I'm going to look it up
later.
You
should, Andrew, because it makes a lot of difference.
It is, and I'm going to write them a sternly worded email suggesting they should do some sort of outreach advertisement involving some guy who rides dolphins and hits the heads off people who don't vote. On that happy image, we will have to leave it there. Kathleen Burke, Professor of Modern Contemporary History at UCL. Daniela Peled, Editor of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. Thank you very much both for joining us.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. 这是 Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And plenty to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll be checking in with one of our correspondents around the world, bringing you our weekly review of the latest theatrical openings. And before the end of the programme... Those people shouting are at the Cannes Film Festival, a preview of which we will have. It begins today. But before we get started on all that, Barney Burnham has the news headlines.
Thanks, Andrew. At least 245 people are now known to have died in Tuesday's explosion and fire at a coal mine in Turkey. 80 more were injured. At least 100 are still missing. Ukraine's interim leaders have pushed a plan to allow the regions a greater say over their affairs, but the exclusion of separatists from roundtable talks in Kiev has cast doubt over whether the move could defuse the crisis. Britain and the United States have warned of potential terrorist attacks in Kenya, with British citizens urged to immediately leave the port city of Mombasa. Another round of talks on Iran's nuclear programs underway in Vienna. The US, Russia, China and EU powers have warned there's no guarantee a long-term deal on Tehran's atomic work is possible. The search has started for a new envoy to the crisis in Syria after Lakhdar Brahimi announced he's stepping down. After 2 years of unsuccessfully trying to find a solution to the country's civil war, he said he was sad to be leaving Syria in such a state. A one-year-old baby boy has survived a fall from the 11th floor of an apartment building in Minneapolis. Musa Daib broke both arms and is breathing with the help of a ventilator after slipping through a railing on the balcony, but he is expected to live. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Barney, and welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. The Cannes Film Festival begins today. The great and the good and indeed the just mediocre and bandwagon chasing of the world's film industries have all descended on the French Riviera. The film critic Tim Robey tells us what he's looking forward to.
The opening film, Grace of Monaco, has press screened this morning and the reactions have not been very good. It's a bit of a stinker, to be honest with you. It's not the best way to get the festival off on the right foot, but I think there's loads of good stuff in the coming days that will kind of lift the mood. You can see on paper why they would want it as their opener, because it's set on the Riviera, and you can play up the kind of high style, the kind of Grace Kelly look, and you get the red carpet ingredients, you get Nicole Kidman and Tim Roth turning up and all of that, plus the director, Olivier Dahan, is well known in France, and he managed to get an Oscar for Marion Cotillard playing Edith Piaf, so you know he has pedigree. But as a director in English language drama, he is really lacking any sense of kind of like ridiculousness. It feels wildly over the top. It feels as though it's a film that makes The Great Gatsby look restrained, which was last year's opener.
Everything I do or say is wrong. Everything.
Why are you still here, Grace?
Because I still love you.
She's meeting with a French private detective.
Family is all that matters. So what did De Gaulle promise you to sell out yours?
Mommy, why are you crying?
If your family is to survive, you need to give them an ideal they can protect. And you need to do it alone.
I still think she's fighting, basically, being miscast, that there's something too brittle about her and too nervy about her to kind of convey Grace Kelly's sort of serenity, if you like. It's not a brilliant performance, but she's by no means the worst person in the film. There are a lot of people kind of hamming it up, and Derek Jacobi essentially playing Julie Andrews in The Princess Diaries. He turns up to give her lessons in deportment with a parrot on his shoulder, and at that point you realize that you've kind of reached kind of kitsch heaven, really. And there's a lot of stuff, particularly in competition and also in the director's fortnight strand of films, which I'm really excited about. There's a film called Foxcatcher, which was delayed. It was supposed to come out a year ago, and apparently the studio had big hopes for it as a kind of extremely serious awards contender. That stars Steve Carell, funnily enough, and Channing Tatum, but it's about this weird true life story. The director is Bennett Miller, who made Capote and Moneyball. Looking forward to that a lot. Tommy Lee Jones has another film as a director here. It's his second film after the Three Burials of Melquiades Estrada, which was great, an underseen film from 2005. Mike Leigh's new film, which I've actually seen, is very good. Mr. Turner, so there you have a biopic which works because it has kind of a vision of the man that's convincing. Timothy Spall, I think he's just a little bit overripe in the main role, but it is Mike Leigh's kind of most visually imaginative film ever, which counts for a lot. David Cronenberg has a new film, and I'm always keen to see what he's come up with. It's called Maps to the Stars. It's some sort of Hollywood satire with a great cast, John Cusack, Mia Wasikowska, Robert Pattinson, Julianne Moore. I hear good things about that. And there's an excellent Russian director, I should say, Andrei Zviagintsev, who's had films out here before. And his new one, Leviathan, looks great. And also, let's not forget, there's a three-hour-long epic from the Turkish director of Once Upon a Time in Anatolia called Winter Sleep, which I think people are already putting money on for to win the Palme d'Or. Artık yaşlandığımı, kafayı mı oynattın? Yoksa başka bir adam mı oldun? Nasıl istersen öyle düşün. There's a second film I'm really looking forward to called It Follows. An American indie director called David Robert Mitchell, who made a film about 3 years ago called The Myth of the American Sleepover, which I thought was a completely great debut. So I'm really excited to see what he's come up with next. And also another second film is by the Italian director Alice Rohrwacher, who made a film called Corpo Celeste. She's got a film called The Wonders.
Piano, avanza così.
Come vi chiamate?
Caterina.
Giuseppe.
There's often a lot of criticism that Cannes doesn't program enough films by female directors in its main strand, but this year they have at least got two. The other one is a Japanese director called Naomi Kawase, who has already declared her own film a masterpiece. So we can't wait. We can't wait to see if it lives up to that billing. The Turkish director Nuri Bilge Ceylan, whose film Once Upon a Time in Anatolia kind of came second in Cannes a few years ago. It was just pipped to the Palme d'Or by The Tree of Life. I think that has a good shout. I mean, it is 3 hours and 20 minutes long, but luckily they've scheduled it for us kind of towards the beginning of the festival so that everyone isn't just kind of in a coma by the point when it plays. So that, I think that, sight unseen, that looks like a strong contender. Also, yeah, the Russian film, Leviathan, I think, could be really great. Mike Leigh has a good shout. David Cronenberg has never won. I wonder if this might be his year. It's possible. And yeah, there are quite a few others. It's all to play for.
Tim Robey struggling manfully through this year's Cannes Film Festival, which begins today. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's time now to check in one of our correspondents around the world. We'll be doing that shortly after this.
Should cities ban the car? Can we make truly sustainable metropolises? What happens if neighbourhoods lose their corner shops? How do you put a stop to suburban decay? Do children belong in big bad capitals? Can Detroit be saved? Can Sydney become a cycle capital? Can we learn to love concrete? And are rich cities always boring? If you want the answers to the big questions facing our cities, you need to tune in to The Urbanist, Monocle 24 Radio's weekly show about the cities we live in. Expect global reports, great interviews, passionate debate, and some surprises too, because drag star taxi drivers, love motel owners, and retail rebels also get their say. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 hours London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
It has just gone 18:39 here in London. That's 21:39 in Moscow, 14:39 in Rio de Janeiro. It's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today it is the turn of Serbia and our Belgrade correspondent, Guy Delaunay. Guy, Aleksandar Vučić is off to Bosnia on his first trip as Prime Minister. He may not be universally popular.
Because he was a die-hard nationalist in the 90s.
Die-hard nationalist is a tactful way of putting it. Unreconstructed headbanger would be another one.
Well,
We appear to have lost Guy there. Possibly the Prime Minister overheard us. We will try to get him back. I'll be right back shortly.
The menu isn't just about food or drinks. It's about the people with innovative ideas, the ones who savor traditions, and the ones who are willing to go further than most in search of the most delicious ingredients. Whether it's an author who's discovered true adventure through food, or a master bartender traveling the world in search of new and exciting flavors, the menu uncovers the tastiest tales from around the globe.
We are finally walking to the simple way of eating, being, but I think it's a universal trend, this kind of simplicity.
As well as going behind the scenes with top chefs such as René Redzepi and Massimo Bottura, we find out the latest in restaurant design, the creative culinary experiences keeping city dwellers' taste buds tingling, and what Japanese clubbing culture and noodles have in common. Join me, Markus Hippi, for the menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
We can return now to Guy Delaunay in Belgrade. Guy, we were just saying that Aleksandar Vučić, now Serbia's prime minister, who was in the 1990s an enthusiastic cheerleader for Serbia's rampage in Bosnia, is about to go to Bosnia in his first overseas trip in his new job. How is it likely to go?
Indeed, he's already there, and he's been saying some very conciliatory things, which is just as well, really, when you consider what he said in the 1990s. You referred to him just before as a headbanger. Well, let me give you a quote from Aleksandar Vučić in July 1995. This is just days after the Bosnian Serb army massacred 8,000 Muslim men and boys. He said, "You kill one Serb and we will kill 100 Muslims." And now this is the sort of talk which is very difficult to forget. Aleksandar Vučić has been saying over the past 6 years, since he renounced his nationalist ways, became a pro-European Union pragmatist, he's been saying, "I made some terrible mistakes. We all made terrible mistakes. I want to put this right." And now this is the audience he's got to address, the people in Bosnia. And first off, he's been in Sarajevo, speaking to people there and trying to reassure them that he's not going to reignite that kind of rhetoric.
How forgiving a mood is Bosnia likely to be? And I mean, Vučić is not the only ex-Yugoslav politician. Indeed, there are plenty of them running around Bosnia who's changed their spots fairly dramatically, in accordance with the prevailing political currents. But as you were pointing out, he was the deliverer of some fairly ripe rhetoric at a time when that was an extremely dangerous and volatile thing to be doing.
Indeed. In fact, it's not exactly an unvolatile time at the moment. We've had riots all over Bosnia this year as people have got completely fed up with the utterly inept system that they have there, where it seems to serve the politicians and nobody else. Politicians are getting richer and everybody else getting poorer, and government buildings were burning across Bosnia in February. So, and into that, of course, when you've got that sort of mood, you have separatists, and there are still separatists out there, Croat separatists, Serb separatists, saying, well, this state isn't functioning, we should just split off and accept the inevitable demise of Bosnia. So it's very interesting that Vučić is saying in Sarajevo, he's promoting the idea of a single Bosnia. He said he respects the territorial integrity of the country, and again, this pragmatic note coming through, that does not need to be much love, but there needs to be respect and esteem. You have that on the Serbian side.
Have the stakes been raised in Bosnia to the not dissimilar situation in Ukraine, where you have a separatist faction in the east of a country being, if not encouraged, then certainly feeling attached to an ethnically similar or ethnically congruent neighbouring power?
Of course, people have been drawing parallels, but, the situation is very different. If you're in Ukraine, you've got a very large, very powerful neighbour, only too happy to help you out. The Republic of Srpska, the ethnic Serb part of Bosnia, has got a rather small Serbia, which couldn't really be said to be powerful, which is now moving towards European Union membership. And the last thing Serbia wants to do, if it wants to keep that membership ambition on track, is to stir up trouble in Bosnia. So there have even been people saying that the fact that Vučić has chosen Bosnia as his first overseas trip shows the EU is in leaning on him to make statements like this. He denies that. Of course he would.
Back in Serbia, rather, I understand there is an initiative to get the people's servants to work on time.
Absolutely. The new government, and this government has officially been working since the end of April, they've issued, but they're all about, you know, getting Serbia back on track. And if you want to give the impression of doing this, perhaps you should get government workers into your offices at 7:30 in the morning rather than 9 o'clock. And this is all part of this great drive to reduce public spending and get better value out of public sector workers. But everybody's been reading the script, Andrew. And one of the newspapers here, Blitz, sat outside the president's office every morning last week and discovered that old Tomat doesn't get to work until 9 o'clock every morning.
Guy Delaney, Monocle's Belgrade correspondent, thank you very much for joining us. Stay tuned. We'll be back with some music shortly. It's time now for a song. Earlier we heard Tim Robey, the film critic, discussing the completely terrible-sounding new film about Princess Grace of Monaco. This is a much better song about an entirely different Monegasque princess. This is The Go-Betweens with Caroline and I. Go-Betweens with Caroline and I. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, and it's time now to review one corner of the arts from one particular corner of the world. Today we're talking theatre in New York City with the theatre critic Matt Wolfe. Matt, welcome back.
Thank you.
To Monocle 24. What has been catching your eye up and down Broadway?
Well, it's a good time, first of all, to be on Broadway. May is always one of the best times of the year because it's Tony Awards season. And as we know, Americans live for one thing and one thing alone, which is awards. So the strange thing, there are only 44 shows or something like that that open across Broadway in an entire season. But it seems like most of them open in the last month of the Tony eligibility so that they're fresh in people's minds. The result is that there is a lot going on at the moment. Just to pick a couple of titles that have achieved some prominence and a couple of themes as well. Neil Patrick Harris, very, very popular television star in the States. He was a child star, actually, way back when. Now he's an adult.
Was Neil Patrick Harris Doogie Howser?
Certainly was. Well remembered.
I'm good in pub quizzes if anyone needs anybody.
Well, actually, we'll keep that in mind under this. There's one going up in North London. But he was in short trousers then. Now he's wearing a dress and often not much of anything at all in an extraordinary sort of pop rock concert happening, which is also a theater piece called Hedwig and the Angry Inch. This is a show that was first done off Broadway in the late 90s. Then it was made into a very peculiar but extraordinary film. And now it's on Broadway where it's charging $300 and more. It's a real tour de force for Neil Patrick Harris. And I think that should be at the top of most people's lists.
Is it $300 worth of tour de force?
It pretty much is. It's quite something to see him abseil down from the ceiling at the beginning and basically keep a Broadway audience in the palm of his proverbial hand and do something that I really don't know how he does it seven times a week. I thought at the end of the performance I'd say he'd be dead, but actually he returned to do it twice more the next day. It's interesting because he is wearing, as I say, a frock or not much for most of the performance. And this seems to be the theme on Broadway this season, men dressed either in not very much or as women. And if I were an actress in New York right now, I might be wondering why the men have taken all my roles.
Where else are we seeing this theme emerging?
Well, there's a very good play by the multi-Tony Award-winning writer Harvey Fierstein called Casa Valentina, which is actually set at a Catskills resort in 1962. This is based on an actual place that existed.
We did an item on this on The Daily a few weeks ago. This very disregarded subculture of heterosexual men with normal suburban lives who just used to enjoy getting together and dressing up as women.
And having these other lives. But it was, in their view of it, absolutely normal. There was nothing kind of strange about it. It was just sort of another life. And it's a very telling and affecting play. It does have two women in the cast, actually, one of whom is Mare Winningham, who you will, with your pop quiz cap on, remember as one of the Brat Pack people, way back when with Ali Sheedy and Judd Nelson.
She's a minor member of the Brat Pack, though. Which films was she in?
Oh, God, now you're asking me. Cinema's Fire, I think, one of them.
That's getting pretty niche, Brat Pack.
It's very niche, but the interesting thing is, Andrew, she has had a much more extended career than a lot of them. When's the last time you saw Judd Nelson on Broadway? Let's park that idea.
Other than selling hot dogs to passers-by.
Well, that quite exactly. So Casa Valentina, very much worth seeing with or without the cross-dressing theme. It's just a bloody good play. And then Alan Cumming, disproving the adage that you can't go home again, has come home again to his Tony Award-winning Broadway performance as the MC in Cabaret. This is, of course, the iconic Broadway musical from the 60s that Alan Cumming did in Revival in New York in 1998. And he was absolutely clasped to New York's bosom, and he's still been part of that anatomy ever since. And 16 years later, here he is, I would have to say, better than ever.
Okay, well, we do have a clip of the Cabaret 3.0, I guess we're up to now.
Because of her cheeks. See? Lulu. She's a tiger. Frenchie.
Oh la la.
She loves to polish. And Texas. You like Texas? Well, too bad. Because Texas likes girls. Rosie, Lulu, Frenchie, and Texas. Each and everyone a virgin. You don't believe me? Don't take my word for it. Go ahead, try her.
It's Alan Cumming in his previous incarnation in Cabaret, now being revived on Broadway, discussed by my guest, Matt Wolfe. This also stars, I believe, and I do know without looking up that she was in Dawson's Creek, Michelle Williams.
Yeah, although, of course, let's be fair to her, since Dawson's Creek, she's had quite a few Oscar nominations.
I was trying to sort of stick with the whole sort of Brat Pack-ish
thing. You're very, very good. This is interesting because she's a proper theater actress. She actually, against the odds, did a Mike Leigh play of all people off Broadway some years ago, right after Dawson's Creek had ended. This is her Broadway debut. It's also her musical theater debut, playing Sally Bowles, the Liza Minnelli part.
And how does she do?
She does very well. I think that she needs to just nestle into it a bit more. It's tricky acting opposite somebody for whom this has become actually like another appendage to him. He's so far inside the material. She has to play cut glass Mayfair, sophisticate, and sing, albeit with dubious skill. She hasn't quite got there, but she's well on her way. The production by Sam Mendes and Rob Marshall remains a marvel because it is absolutely scintillating and entertaining. And then, just when you're being seduced, it turns around and sticks the knife in, which is what the material has to do because, of course, it's about the rise of the Third Reich.
Another play we do need to talk about, which is possibly a little bit less of a toe-tapper than Cabaret, is a production of Sean O'Casey's Silver Tassie.
Yeah, that's this side of the pond. And it's always interesting on Broadway because you think, gosh, there are all these glitzy things with sequins and baubles and bangles and beads. Where are the classics? And if you want the classics, come to London. O'Casey's Silver Tassie is a brilliant anti-war play from the 1920s. It is being given by the National Theatre at the moment, one of the great productions I think they've done in recent years. Very powerful, very disturbing. It's about a football hero who comes back during the First World War. On the eve of going to fight in the trenches, he does go off. He comes back again, wounded and scarred forever. And it is a bruising piece, brilliantly done by Howard Davis.
We do have a brief clip, I think.
A service to my army.
One, be gone by the old golden fight. Well, lift it up, Jesse. Sign of youth, sign of strength, sign of victory.
War,
a clip from a new production of Sean O'Casey's Silver Tassie. I mean, an inevitable, I get the 100th anniversary of the beginning of the First World War has been reflected in media of all kinds at the moment. Is this one worth sort of... Is this wheat worth sorting from the chaff, I guess I'm asking?
Absolutely. It's nourishing, to extend that metaphor, in every possible regard. There have been any number, as you say, of centenary-related events, and of the ones I've seen, this is far and away the best. It is what the National does at the very top of its considerable game.
Theatre critic Matt Wolfe, thank you very much as ever for joining us on Pleasure. Monocle 24. That is all for this edition of Midori House. My thanks to our special guests Kathleen Burke of UCL, Daniela Pellid of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and of course Matt Wolfe, who we just heard from. Today's show was produced by Thomas Lewis, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Alexandra Stenbock-Firmer, and our studio manager was Alex Funnell. After the headlines at 1900 London time, we'll have The Entrepreneurs with Daniel Giacopelli. At 2200, I'll be back with Chloe Potter for The Monocle Daily. This show returns at 1800 tomorrow at London time, but for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.